I won't let you, you stubborn old Shigorf. Try to stop me, senile Yankee Polak vieillard. Shrew, salon, ball-breaking old bat, espèce de con. Shut the hell up, thundered Felice. The pair of you are as bad as Richard and Martha. The pirate grinned, and Martha turned away, nibbling her lip to suppress laughter. Claude's face blackened with embarrassed rage, and Madame was stunned out of her hauteur. Richard said, You two listen to me. The row field of the flux tapper will prevent any of the Tanuhunt from touching the aircraft. It'll probably deflect lances and arrows and whatnot, too. So all we really have to worry about is mental attack. For countering that, our only hope is Madame's metapsychic screen.
If I had a torque, Felice muttered.
Richard asked Madame, How long can you hold out against a bunch of them?
I don't know, she admitted. We will be disguised as vapor until we direct the first blasts at the city wall. Then they will know an enemy is there, and many minds will be brought to bear upon my little screen. It is certain to be pierced. We can hope that this will happen after we strike at the mine. Once this is done, we can flee at top speed.
How fast can Veltaine's outfit fly, anyhow? Richard asked.
Not much faster than a Chalico at full gallop. The mind of this Tano champion is able to levitate his own steed and those of 21 warriors through PK, psychokinesis. There's only one other who is capable of such a feat, and that is Nodon, the Tano battlemaster and lord of Garaya in Brittany. He can support 50. There are others who can levitate themselves individually, and a few who can carry one or two other persons, but none is strong enough to support many riders save these two.
If I had a torque, Felice wailed. Oh, wait, just wait.
We'll leave him in the dust, Richard scoffed. A couple of zaps to take out the wall on either end of the city, maybe one for the Tanu quarter to demoralize the opposition, then the big Zorch for the mine. If that spear really is a portable cannon, we can melt the place to a slag heap. And come home safely ourselves, Claude said, staring into the fire, while our friends fight it out on the ground.
Veltaine will try to defend his realm, Madame warned them. He is exceptionally strong in creativity, and there are strong coercers in his company. We will be in great danger. Nevertheless, we will go. And we will succeed.
There was a loud snap, and an ember flew through the air like a meteor, landing in front of the old woman. She got up and stamped upon it with great thoroughness.
I believe it is time for us to retire. We will want to get up early for Richard's test flight.
Martha rose from her place and said to Richard,
Come for a little walk with me before we settle down.
Conserve your strength, Sherry,
Madame warned. We'll just go a little way, Richard said. He slipped one arm around the engineer's waist to steady her. They went out of the pool of firelight, leaving the others still talking, and walked to the far side of the camp clearing. Only stars illuminated the tangle of maquis, for the new moon had gone down. Above them was the overgrown slope with its narrow trail leading to the crater rim. They could not see the refurbished flyer, but they knew it was up there waiting.
We've been happy, Richard. Can you figure it, a pair like us?
Two of a kind, Marty. I love you, babe. I never thought it could happen.
All you needed was a good old-fashioned sexy girl.
Fool, he said, and kissed her eyes and cold lips.
When it's all over, do you think we could come back?
Back? He repeated stupidly.
After the Fenaya attack. You know we're going to have to teach others how to fly the machine and maintain it so that they can carry out the other two phases of Madame's plan. But you and I needn't worry about those. We'll have paid our dues. We can have them fly us back here and then...
She turned to him, and he held her, too frail and racked by cramps and hemorrhage to endure any further intercourse. She had still insisted upon consoling him. They spent every night in each other's arms, sharing one of the Decimal huts. Don't worry, Marty. Amory will know how to fix you up for good. We'll come back here somehow and get a flyer just for ourselves, and find us a good place to live. No more Tano, no more Fervalog or Howlers, no more people at all.
Just you and me. We'll find a place. I promise.
I love you, Richard, she said. Whatever happens, we've had this.
In the morning, Richard waved goodbye to the others and went up to where the bird stood. It still looked pretty scruffy in spite of the scraping, but he'd soon fix that. He settled into the pilot seat and patted the console in the manner of an equestrian soothing a skittish mount. Oh, you beautiful droop-snoot swivel-winged thing. You wouldn't badass the old cap'n, would you? Course not. We're gonna fly today. He lit her up and went through the checklist. A familiar sweet hum of row-field generators came to him there on the flight deck, and he grinned at the thought of microscopic thermonuclear reactions hitting nicely on all 16, ready to wave a net of subtle forces that would free the metal bird from gravity's domain. All of the engine idiot lights gleamed Scion for go. Keeping her firmly latched to Earth, he fed juice to the external web. The bird's scabby skin glowed faintly purplish in the bright sunshine as the row-field reticula clothed it lightly. All the crud that he'd been unable to remove sizzled away, leaving the surface a smooth cerametal black, just what you'd expect for an aircraft with orbiter capability. He cut in the environmental system. Oh yeah, little bluey-green lights telling him that no matter where the ship carried him, his life would be duly supported. Ease off on the field web run-up. Crank back the wings to minimum area until he got used to them. No use risking over-control on his maiden flight, wallowing all over the sky like a shot duck. Gotta do this with class, Captain Voorhees. Okay. Okay. And upsy-daisy. Straight up and dead level, and hold at squiggle 100 meters according to the readout on the indecipherable altimeter display. Call it 400. Down below, the Rees crater was a great blue cup with little spread-winged birds strung around its western lip, politely waiting for permission to drink. There were 42 of them, and one missing where a section of the rim had collapsed in a landslide, and one empty slot for his own aircraft. Damn those wings when the wind caught him at hover. He'd better move. Slowly, slowly, bank and zoom. Figure 8 and vertical 5 and stop and start and swoop and glide and pendulum arc and... Hot damn! He was doing it! Down on the ground, 4 small figures were jumping up and down. He did a creditable imitation of a wing waggle to let them know that he had seen them, then laughed out loud. And now, my friends, fare thee well, for I must leave you. We'll save the touch-and-goes for later. Now the old captain is going to give himself a few lessons in how to drive this here flying machine. He slammed the row field into full inertialess web, stuck a burr under her tail, and took off vertically for the ionosphere. 9. Would volunteers come? As the days of September dwindled and the preparations at Hidden Springs were completed, this question was paramount among the followers of Madame Goudrian. Her influence, and indeed, the benefits of her Firvelog human entente, did not extend much farther than the tiny settlements of the Vosges and the Upper Saône wilderness, a region that would be able to muster not more than 100 fighters. Communication with other low-life enclaves was minimal because of the danger from hunts, grey torque patrols, howlers, and even nominal subjects of King Yochi, who were reluctant to give up their human-harassing ways. Before leaving Hyvrazel, Madame and Chief Burke had discussed this problem with the shrewd old battlemaster of the Shapechangers, Pelol One-Eye. It had been agreed that the only hope for recruitment of more distant humans lay in the hands of the Firvelog. Only the illusion spinners could hope to shepherd groups of low-life fighters from the far villages to Hidden Springs in time for the Fenaya attack, but it was clearly going to take more than a simple call to arms to budge skeptical humans from their swamps or mountain fastnesses, especially if the invitation to the war was delivered by the little exotics. Madame and Pio had recorded joint appeals on AV letter plaques and left these with Pelon. However, the Firvelog messengers would have to establish credibility for the enterprise, and to this end a certain stratagem proposed by the battlemaster was ultimately agreed upon. At the same time that Madame's expedition left Hyvrazel for the ship's grave, picked Fervalog teams, including King Yochi's most tactful grand combat referees, had set out on journeys to the south and west to summon all of the lowlives in the known world to participate in the strike against Fenaya. The little people went laden with gifts, and it happened that lonely huddles of cabins tucked away among the volcanoes of the Massif Central were visited at night by benevolent pixies. Bags of finely milled flour, flagons of honey and wine, luscious cheeses, candy, and other rare dainties appeared mysteriously on human doorsteps. Missing geese and sheep unaccountably found their way back to their pens. Even lost children were guided home safely by butterflies or will-o'-the-wisps. On the mountain slopes of the Jura, a poorly tanned deerskin pegged to the wall of a low-life hovel might disappear, and in its place, the delighted inhabitants would discover well-cobbled boots, fur jerkins, and butter-soft suede garments. Deep in the swamps of the Paris Basin, the fen-dwellers would find that rotting punts were exchanged for new decimal dinghies stolen from Tanu caravans. Great nets of waterfowl were left where outlaw human hunters could find them. Plastic containers of survival unit insect repellent, more precious than rubies, appeared on the windowsills of the stilt-legged marshland houses where no passerby could possibly have reached. In scores of low-life settlements, humans were amazed when odd jobs were done by invisible helpers. Sick folks were nursed by elfin women who vanished with the dawn. Broken things were mended. Empty larders were filled. And always there were gifts, gifts, gifts. Finally, when the Fervalog messengers ventured to appear en clair and present the awesome plan of Madame Gudrian, who was, of course, known to all of the fugitives, the lowlives were at least willing to listen. Fewer numbers agreed to respond to the appeal for fighting volunteers, for there were many emotional burnouts and physical cripples among them, as well as a sizable percentage who cared only for their own skins. But the bolder, the healthier, and the more idealistic spirits were fired by the notion of striking a blow against the hated Tanu, while others agreed to participate in the attacks when the subject of loot was delicately broached. So the Fervalog emissaries began to return, and those at Hidden Springs exulted, because they brought with them a total of nearly 400 men and women, recruited from places as far away as Bordeaux and Albion, and the tidal estuaries of the Anversian Sea. These were welcomed in the name of free humanity, briefly trained, and equipped with weapons of bronze and vitredur. None of the newcomers, it had been agreed, would be told of the iron until the very day of the attack, and only the most competent of the volunteer fighters would be armed with the precious metal. The secret staging area in the Rhineland bottoms opposite Fenaya was in a state of full readiness by the middle of the last week in September. Lowlife warriors and a contingent of crack Fervalog stalwarts were poised to cross the river in sailing lighters belonging to the little people. The boats would be disguised as blobs of mist for as long as the most powerful Tanu did not consciously seek to penetrate them. Another Fervalog force was concealed farther upstream in a second camp, primed to strike at the second break in the city wall, which was supposed to be made roughly opposite to the main thrust. Tactics and targets had been decided upon, and logistic preparations were complete. All that remained was the arrival of the Spear of Lugan. "The hunt flies tonight, Peopeo Mux Mux Burke." It was very dark in the cypress swamp, for the moon was down. Chief Burke focused his night ocular on the activity across the river. The high, narrow-necked peninsula upon which the Tanu city perched was, as always, ablaze with an incredible display of colored lights. The much sharper vision of Pelol One Eye had already discerned what the chief now viewed through his scope, a glowing procession rising from the topmost parapet of House Beltane. It spiraled slowly toward the zenith, the figures of the flying hunt distinct even at a distance of 2 kilometers. Tanu riders, whose faceted armor flashed every color of the rainbow, mounted upward on great white chalicoes. The legs of the steeds pumped in unison as they galloped into the airy darkness. There were 21 knights in the train and another who forged ahead to lead them, his billowing cloak streaming back like a comet tail of vaporous silver. From the distance came the faint notes of a horn. "They're turning south, Battlemaster," said Burke. Beside him, Palol One-Eye nodded, he who had seen 600 winters upon his own far world, and more than 1,000 orbits of the nearly seasonless Pliocene Earth. He was taller than the Native American, and nearly twice as massive, and he moved as fluidly as the black, man-sized otters of the riverine jungle, whose form, three times magnified, he often adopted. His right eye was a great orb of gold, with an iris colored deep red. The left eye was hidden by a jeweled black leather patch. It was whispered that when he lifted that patch in battle, his glance was more deadly than a thunderbolt. Which is to say that the destructive potential of his right brain's creativity was second to none among the Firvalog and the Tanu. But Palol One-Eye was an irascible ancient now, and he had not deigned to soil his obsidian armor at a grand combat for more than 20 years, unable to bear his people's annual humiliation. He had found Madame Gudrian's plan against Fenaya to be mildly amusing, and he had acquiesced in a Firvalog role when both Yeuchi and the young champion, Charmes, decided to support the lowlives. Palol declared that he would lend the effort his good advice, and he had done so. But it was unthinkable that he should participate personally in what he termed Madame's little war. More likely than not, the assault would be indefinitely postponed when the lady failed to return with the vital material. And even if she did bring back the spear, how could mere humans hope to wield it effectively against the bravos of Veltaine? It was a weapon for a hero. And it was all too true that heroes were in short supply among this effete younger generation. "Now they're crossing the Rhine, heading west into the Belfort Gap," Burke said, "no doubt planning to convoy the last caravan from Castle Gateway before the truce." Still, Palol only nodded. "The Tanu can't have any inkling of our preparations, Battlemaster. We've carried it off without a flaw." This time, Palol laughed, a grating sound like the chafing of lava blocks. "Fenaya shines bright across the river, leader of humans. Save yourself congratulations for its snuffing. Madame Gudrian will not return, and all of this scheming against the torque-wearing foe will be for nothing." "Perhaps so, Battlemaster. But even if we don't fight, we've accomplished things that we never dared dream of before. Nearly 500 lowlives have been brought together in a common cause. Only a month ago that would have been an idle fancy. We were scattered and afraid, mostly without hope. But not anymore. We know that there is a chance that we can break the Tanu domination of humanity. If you Firvalog help us, we can do it sooner. But even if you break off the alliance, even if Madame fails to bring back the spear this year, we'll return to fight again. After this, humans will never go back to the old timid ways. Others of us will go searching for the ship's grave if Madame fails. We'll find that ancient weapon and make it work again, something your people could never do. And if the spear is gone, if we never find it, we'll use other weapons until the Tanu slavers are defeated."
"You mean you will use the blood metal," said Palol.
Chief Burke was silent for 12 seconds. "You know about the iron.
The senses of the torque-wearers may be so puny that they require machines to sniff the deadly metal out, but not those of the Firvalog. Your camp reeks of iron."
"We will not use it against our friends. Unless you plan betrayal, you have nothing to fear. The Firvalog are our allies, our brothers in arms.
The Tanu foe are our true brothers, and yet we are fated to contend with them eternally. Could it be otherwise between Firvalog and humanity? This earth is destined to belong to you, and you know it. I do not believe that humanity will be satisfied in allowing us to share. You will never call us brothers. You will call us interlopers and try to destroy us."
"I can speak only for myself," Burke said, "since my tribe, the Walla Walla, becomes extinct upon my death. But there will be no treachery by human against friendly Firvalog as long as I am the general of the lowlives. Pelor One-Eye. I swear it on my blood, which is as red as your own. As for our never being brothers, this is a matter I'm still pondering. There are many different degrees of kinship.
So thought our ship, sighed the old champion. It brought us here.
He tilted his huge head toward the sky.
But why? With so many other yellow stars in the universe, so many possible planets. Why here? With you. The ship was instructed to find the best.
Perhaps, said Peo Peo Mox Mox Burke. The ship took a longer view than you. All day long the birds of prey had circled. They rode thermals above the Vosges woodland in a neat stack, holding most of the time at altitudes appropriate to their species. Lowest was a wheeling flock of small, swallow-tailed kites. Above them soared a mated pair of bronze buzzards. The fire-backed eagles came next, and then a lone lammergeier vulture, mightiest of the bone-crackers. Most lofty of all the circling birds was the one that had initiated the day-long vigil and attracted all of the others. On motionless wings, it orbited at a height so remote that it was barely visible to watchers on the ground. Sister Amarie watched the birds through the sparse branches of a stone pine, her tawny cat resting in her arms.
Wherever the body is, there will the eagles be gathered together.
You quote the Christian scriptures, said Old Man Kawai, who was shading his eyes with a tremulous hand. Do you think the birds are truly clairvoyant? Or do they only hope as we do?
It is late. So late.
Calm yourself, Kawai-san. If they get here tonight, there'll be a whole 24-hour day for the Fervalog to join in the assault. That should be enough. Even if our allies withdraw at sunrise day after tomorrow, we can still win with the help of the iron.
The ancient continued to fret.
What can be keeping, madame? It is such a slim hope, and such hard work we have done here in expectation that the hope would be fulfilled.
Amarie stroked the cat.
If they arrive before dawn tomorrow, the attack can still proceed according to the second alternative.
If they arrive. Have you considered the navigation problem? Richard must come first to Hidden Springs. But how will he find it? Surely these tiny mountain valleys must look much alike from the air, and ours is hidden because of the hunt. Richard will not be able to distinguish our canyon, even in daylight if he approaches at a high altitude, and he does not dare to fly a low-level search lest the enemy observe him.
Amarie was patient.
Madame will conceal the ship mentally, of course. Calm yourself. This constant worry is bad for your health. Here, pet the cat. It's very soothing. When you stroke the fur, you generate negative ions.
Ah, so, Desuka?
We can hope that the flyer would be equipped with an infrared scanner for night flight, just as our eggs of the 22nd century were. Even with all of our fighters gone, there are still more than 30 warm bodies here in Hidden Springs. Richard will sniff us out.
Old Man Kawai sucked in his breath. A horrible thought of a new sort crossed his mind.
The metapsychic concealment of the aircraft. If its volume is more than about 10 cubic meters, Madame will be unable to render it invisible. She will only be able to disguise it somehow and hope that the Tano do not concentrate their perceptive powers too closely upon it. What if the machine is so large that her faculties are insufficient to invest it with a plausible illusion?
She'll think of something.
It is a great danger, he moaned.
The little cat gave him a long-suffering glance as his hand essayed a few nervous pats.
The flying hunt could even discover the aircraft while it rests here. All that is needed is for Veltaine to descend for a close look at my poor camouflage nets. They are pathetic things.
Adequate for night concealment. Veltaine has no infrared, thank God, and he almost never comes this far west nowadays.
Stop your fussing. You'll stew yourself into cardiac arrest. Where's your jiriki?
I am a foolish, useless old man. I would not be here in the first place if I were able to rule myself through Zen. The nets, if they fail their purpose, the fault will be my own. The dishonor.
Amarie gave an exasperated sigh. She thrust the cat at Kawai. Take Deej into Madame's cottage and give her some leftover fish. Then hold her on your lap and close your eyes and pet her. And think of all those lovely tri-Ds that used to come rolling off your assembly lines in Osaka. The old man giggled.
A substitute for counting sheep. Yate mamasu.
It may serve to tranquilize me at that. As you say, there is still time to mount the attack.
Come, kitty. You will share your valued negative ions with me.
He pottered off, but turned after a few steps to say with a sly grin,
However, one incongruity remains. Forgive my flaunting of the obsolete technology, Amari-san, but even the lowliest electronicist knows that it is quite impossible for negative ions to be cat ions.
You get out of here, old man. Tittering, he disappeared into the cottage. Amari walked down the canyon past the huts and cottages, nodding and waving to the few people who, like herself, could not resist watching the sky while they waited and prayed. The last of the able-bodied men and women had marched off under Uva's command 3 days ago, and the deadline for the optimal two-day assault had come and gone. But there was still time to execute the one-day attack. At dawn tomorrow, it could be that human beings would unite together for the first time on this exile world to challenge their oppressors.
Oh, Lord, let it happen. Let Madame and the rest of them get here in time.
It was getting cooler as the sun descended, and soon the thermals, those buoyant upwellings of heated air, would fade away completely, and the soaring raptors would have to come back to Earth. Amari came to her secret place beneath a low but open-armed juniper and lay down, face to the sky, to pray.
It had been such a wonderful month. Her arm had healed quickly, and the people... Oh, Lord, what a fool she had been to think of becoming a hermit!
Hidden Springs folk and the other low-life outlaws of the region had needed her as a physician and counselor and friend. Among them, she had done the work she had been trained for. And what had become of the burnt-out case with the self-punishing compulsion to flee into a haven of solitary penitence? Here she could even pray her divine office, contemplate in the forest stillness. But when the people needed her, she was there ready to help. And they were there to help. And he was there, in the midst of them. It was her dream fulfilled, even in its changing, only now the language that she prayed in was a living one.
I put my trust in the Lord. How dare you say to my soul, Fly away like a sparrow to the mountains, for lo, the wicked draw their bows and aim their arrows, to shoot in the dark the upright of heart. And they have destroyed the good things while just people let the evil happen. But the Lord tests both the just and the wicked. He hates the lawless ones, the evil lovers. Flaming coals and burning sulfur will he pour on them. A fiery whirlwind shall be their punishment.
The Lammergeier flew away to his lair among the high crags, and the eagles descended to their roosting trees an hour before the sunset. The kites scattered, having to satisfy their appetites with insects, and even the buzzards disappeared at last, perhaps wondering what had prompted all of them to waste time, waiting in the futile hope of sharing the great newcomer's prey. He alone still circled, aloof in the high air, completely disdainful of the vanished thermals. And Amari watched him, lying under the tree. Watched that distant speck endlessly wheeling that had drawn all the others and then disappointed them. That bird with motionless wings.
Heart pounding, she scrambled to her feet and ran back up the canyon to rout everybody out.
Stand back! Don't touch it until the field's off, for God's sake! Someone shouted.
The huge thing, still glowing faintly purple, seemed to fill the whole lower end of the canyon. It had descended just as soon as the sky was fully dark, subsonic by a whisker but still, shoving a hurricane blast ahead of it that tore bundles of thatch from the roofs and sent poor old Peppino's geese tumbling like leaves in a gale. It had come to a dead halt no more than 2 meters above the highest trees, its drooping nose, gull wings, and fan-shaped tail bathed in a crawling network of nearly ultra-visible fire. Old Man Kawhi, composed now and curtly efficient, had sent several youngsters for wet sacks and ordered the rest of the villagers to stand by the rolls of camouflage netting. They all watched, awestruck, as the hovering thing folded its great wings back against its 30-meter fuselage and delicately felt its way down. It nosed obliquely between a pair of tail fins, where there was a minimum of undergrowth, hesitated just barely off the ground, and then let its long legs settle. There was a loud hiss. A few bushes began to smolder, and wisps of smoke curled up around the footpads. The skin of the bird went dead black. Then the people, who had stood as though paralyzed, broke into wild cheers. A number sobbed aloud as they rushed to follow Kawhi's orders, beating out the little fires that had been set by the row field and hustling to set up poles and guy ropes for the nets. The belly hatch opened, and the ladder extruded. Slowly, Madame Gudrun came down. Amarie said,
"Welcome home."
"We have brought it," said Madame. "Everything is ready exactly as your plan specified."
Lame Miss Sherilyn, who was 203 and nearly blind, seized one of Madame's hands and kissed it, but the Frenchwoman hardly seemed to notice. Up above, a word of warning came from within the flyer. A litter was lowered from the hatch by Felice and Richard. Madame said only,
"You are needed, monsieur."
And then she turned and walked as in a daze toward her cottage. Amarie knelt down and took one of Martha's bony wrists. Richard stood there in his ruffled pirate shirt and battered buckskins, with fists clenched and tears running down his dirty, sun-scorched cheeks. "She wouldn't let us come back until the spear was working right, and now she's damn near bled to death. Help her, Amarie."
"Follow me," said the nun,
and they rushed off after Madame, carrying the litter with them, leaving Claude to see that the big black bird of prey was safely bedded down for the night. 10. Before dawn, there was the battle mass, and then Madame exerted her far-speech power to transmit an enigmatic, "We come," to Pelon, ensuring that the invasion fleet would be poised to exploit the bombardment of Fania's wall. Sunrise was less than an hour away, and if past performance was any criterion, Lord Veltaine and the members of his flying hunt would be back at their stronghold after the night's foray. Claude strode along nearly at the end of the procession heading for the flyer and wished Felice would shut up. She was once again attired in her black leather ring hockey armor, which had been beautifully refurbished by Old Man Kawhi's artisans, and she was wild with anxiety lest she would miss the war.
"I wouldn't take up any room, and I swear I won't say a word during the flight. Claude, you've got to let me come with you. I can't wait for you to come back after the strike. What if you don't make it?"
"If Veltaine nails the flyer, you'd go down with us."
"But if you get away, you could put me down right outside Fania, say, at the breach of the wall on the land side of the peninsula. I could go in with the Fearvelog on the second wave, please, Claude."
"The hunt could have spotted us by then. Landing could be suicide, and that's not what this fight is all about. Not for me and Madame Gudrion, at any rate. Fania is just the beginning of our war. And Richard's got Martha to live for now."
Up ahead, villagers were pulling the nets from the blackbird. A few candles gleamed in the mist where Amarie was blessing the aircraft.
Felice said, "I could help you with the spear, Claude. You know what an awkward big bastard it is. I could be useful."
She clutched at the old man's bush shirt, and he stopped abruptly and took her by the shoulders.
"Listen to me, girl. Richard is all strung up. He hasn't slept for more than 24 hours, and he's half crazy with worry because of Martha. Even with the transfusions, Amarie gives her less than a 50-50 chance. And now Richard has to fly a combat mission in an exotic aircraft, with a couple of old crocs and the future of Pliocene humanity riding on his tail. You know how he feels about you. Having you in the flyer during the mission could be the last straw. You say that you'd keep out of the way. But I know you couldn't help asserting yourself once the heat was on. So you're staying here, and that's that. We'll do our job and then run for home, and with luck, we'll leave Veltaine completely mystified about where we've gone. We'll come back and pick you up. I promise you that if we make it, we'll get you to the battle not more than an hour or so after the main assault begins."
"Claude,
Claude!
Her face peered through the T-shaped opening in the black hoplite helmet, panic and fury, and some more alien emotion at war with reason. Claude waited, praying that she wouldn't jump him, but he was so steeped in fatigue that he almost didn't give a damn whether or not she knocked him cold and forced the others to let her take his place. It was in her mind, all right, but she also knew that he was by far the better shot.
Oh, Claude!
The blazing brown eyes closed, tears poured behind the cheek pieces of her helmet, and the green plumes flattened as she wrenched away from him and fled back toward Madame's cottage. He let out a long breath.
Be ready when we get back, he called,
and then hurried to where the others were waiting. The great bird crept furtively from its hiding place. When it was in the clear, it mounted the pre-dawn sky like a violet spark, going up an invisible chimney, attaining an altitude of 5,000 meters in a thunderclap inertialess surge. Angelique Gudrian stood beside Richard, clutching the back of his seat with one hand and her golden torque with the other. Richard had changed into his old spacer's coverall.
You got us hidden, madame? He asked.
Yes,
she replied faintly. She had said hardly a word since their safe return.
Claude, you ready?
Whenever you give the word, son.
We're on our way.
A split second later, the belly hatch rolled smoothly back. They hovered motionless above a patch of microscopic jewels, shaped roughly like a tadpole with its tail joined to the eastern bank of the Rhine.
Why, it's on the Kaiserstuhl, Claude said to himself.
The patch grew, spread, its star cluster blur clarifying into twinkling lights as the flyer dropped, subsonically this time, and stopped dead in the air about 200 meters above the highest eminence of the Tanu city.
Give it to him, said Richard.
Claude horsed the great spear into position and took a bead on the line of fiery dots marking the Rhineside wall. Somewhere in the graying mists of the river waited a flotilla of Firvalag boats loaded with human and exotic troops.
Keep her depressed, old man. You don't want to boil your own folks out of the water.
He raised the caplock and swung it wide.
There. Right there.
Touch the second stud. A thin bar of green-white lanced without sound. Down below, a tiny orange flower bloomed, but the line of dots atop the wall remained unbroken.
Shit!
Richard exclaimed.
You missed! Elevate!
Calmly, Claude took aim once again, pressed the stud. This time there was no burst of orange fire, only a dull red glow. Perhaps a dozen of the rampart lamps were swallowed by it.
Hee-yow! Gotcha!
Screeched the pirate. Making a 180, Claudesy boy! Ready for the back door? The flyer spun on its vertical axis and Claude found himself aiming at a point near the base of the shining tadpole's tail. He fired and missed, high. He fired and missed again, low.
Jesus, hurry up, urged Richard.
The third time, the blast struck the wall squarely, melting it at a point where the causeway of the peninsular neck met the extinct volcanic mass of the Kaiserstuhl proper. Madame moaned. Claude felt dragon talons grip his guts.
Are they coming?
Richard demanded.
Hang on, madame. Sweet Christ, Claude, get on with it. Never mind zapping the Tanu buildings, go for the mine.
The old man wrestled the spear around, a sudden burst of sweat greasing his hands and making them slip on the weapon's glassy butt. His used-up muscles trembled as he tried to bring the weapon to bear upon the small blue constellation that marked the mine workings. He could not depress the spear sufficiently to bring the target into range.
Quick, Richard! Take her a couple of 100 meters south.
Aye,
growled the pirate. The flyer changed position in the twinkle of an eye.
That better?
Wait. Yes, I've just about got her. Have to do this right the first time. Only have one blast at full zap.
Merde alors,
Madame whispered. The old woman staggered away from Richard to crash against the right bulkhead. Fists pressed to her temple, she began to scream. Claude had never heard such a sound from a human throat. Such a distillation of anguish, horror, and despair. At the same moment, something flashed past the flight deck port. It glowed neon red and was shaped like a mounted knight.
Oh, God, said Richard flatly.
Madame's screams cut off, and she fell senseless to the deck.
How many?
Asked Claude. He tried to get a grip on himself, tried to steady the heavy spear on target, prayed that his damned old body wouldn't betray him at this last extremity. They had almost done it. Almost.
I make it 22. Richard's calm voice seemed to come from a considerable distance. The whole round table circling us like Sioux around a wagon train, all scarlet except the leader, and I'd put his spectral class somewhere in the B-0 range.
Look out!
One of the figures, the blue-white one, soared down and took a position immediately below the flyer. He drew his glassy sword and thrust it upward. Three Roman candle globes of ball lightning left the tip and soared rather slowly toward the open belly hatch. Claude dodged, pulling the spear out of the way, and the things flew into the aircraft, where they began caroming off the panels and decking, hissing and emitting a fearful smell of ozone.
Shoot! Shrieked Richard. For God's sake, shoot!
Claude took one deep breath. He said, Steady, son! And aimed, depressing the fifth stud of the Spear of Lugan just as the little blue lights centered themselves in the weapon's sight. An emerald bar jabbed once at the spangled earth. Where it struck, the rock went white, yellow, orange, roiling crimson like a flame-armed starfish. Claude fell sideways and the spear clanged to the deck. The belly hatch started to close. Lightning balls bounced and crackled. The old man felt one of them strike him in the back, rolling up his spine from buttocks to the base of his neck, burning all the way. The interior of the flyer was filled with smoke and the smell of burnt flesh and fabric. There were sounds, too. Claude discovered, as he studied the scene from afar, a sizzle as the remaining two energy balls sought their targets, curses, and then a thin scream from Richard, a whimpering sob from Angelique as she tried to creep toward him over the smeared deck, someone breathing in and out in harsh rhythmic persistence.
Get it away from me, a frantic voice cried. I can't see to land. Oh, damn it, no!
A jarring crash. And a slow tilt to one side. Claude felt a breeze, amazing the way it seared his back, and the hatch opened. A peculiarly angled surface of grassy ground, gray and dim in the first light of morning, Richard sobbing and cursing, Angelique making no sound, voices shouting, heads poking up through the hatch, again at that odd angle. Wails from that silly youngster, old man Kawhi, Amory's familiar tones. Go easy, go easy. Felice spitting obscenities when somebody said she was going to get her armor all messed up. Put him over my shoulder, I can carry him. Stop your wiggling, Claude, silly old fart. Now I'm going to have to walk all the way to the war. He laughed, poor Felice. And then his face was upside down among her green skirts and he was jouncing up and down and he screamed. But after a little bit the movement stopped and they laid him on his stomach and something touched his temple, making the pain and the rest of it grow muzzy. He said,
Angelique, Richard.
Unseen, Amarie replied,
They'll recover, you all will. You did it, Claude. Sleep now.
Well, how about that? And for a moment, he saw the fiery starfish again, but with crimson and gold limbs expanding, branching out among the hapless, helpless firefly patterns of Fenaya streets, in the instant before the hatch of the flyer slammed shut.
How about that? And if the lava kept oozing out of the old Kaiserstuhl volcano for even a little while, it was going to be a long, long time before they mined any more barium in the regions around there.
Don't worry about it, Claude, Felice said. And so he stopped. 11. Half-dozing in the dead hour before dawn, Mo Marshak and the other human troops on duty in Fenaya had mistaken the first blast of the photon weapon for a lightning stroke. The thin green beam had lanced out of the stars, barely missing the Rhineside wall that the Greytorg garrison manned, and demolishing an adjacent mess hall inside the compound. Marshak was still gaping at the flames consuming the wreckage, when Claude's second shot struck the number 10 bastion squarely, breaching the fortification not a dozen meters from Marshak's station. Great blocks of granite flew in all directions, and the air boiled with smoke and dust. Oil tubs that held the watchfires spilled in the concussion and sent blazing rivulets racing down the cracked walkway. When Marshak was able to get a grip on himself, he rushed to look through one of the embrasures.
There, in the fog-blurred waters below, were the boats.
"Alert!"
he shouted aloud. And then his mind sent the alarm on the declamatory mode, amplified by his gray torque. Marshak.
Invasion, via Rhine. Wall breach, Station 10.
Captain Wang.
How the hell many be there, Mo? How many boats?
Marshak.
Whole fucking river full. 80 hundred who can count damn fog bastards everywhere. Fervalog boats, but let me see. Yes, lowlives, too. Repeat, lowlives plus foe invading. Landings. Rocks swarming damn fuckers penetrating breach estimate hole. Maybe 9 meters max.
Cornet Formby.
All troops of watch to Station 10. General alert, Rhine garrison to arms. Duty observers, scan slash report. Defensive units, to wall stations. Cancel, cancel, cancel. Defensive units, to garrison compound. Invader penetration compound.
Commander Seaborg.
Lord Veltine, alert. Firvalog and human invasion force has penetrated the city fortifications and breached number 10 station. Countering.
Lord Veltane of Fenaya.
Kinfolk, arise and defend. Flyers to saddle.
Nabardito! Nabardito tenel oporenkon!
Chief Burke and Uwe Goldensop led the mob of Vosges lowlives and outland volunteers up the street rampart and across the tumbled rumble of the breakthrough. Vitrador arrows and crossbow bolts rained down from the battlements, but until the defenders could redeploy at ground level, the invaders would have a brief advantage. As bad luck would have it, the breach was within the grounds of the principal Fenaya garrison. In addition to the confusion caused by the mess hall conflagration, which was spreading to adjoining structures, a Chalico stable had been broken open by falling debris and numbers of the great animals were loose. 3 soldiers ran from the guardhouse at the compound gate.
"Take 'em!"
yelled Burke, and howling desperados fell upon the little force and cut it to pieces.
"Out of here! Into the city streets! And get this gate off the hinges!"
Troops were pouring from the barracks, some with their armor only half strapped on. Free-for-all clashes erupted everywhere in the murk as invaders scrambled through the broken wall, while the human minions of the Tanu strove to press them back. The irregulars trying to unhinge the gates were attacked and overwhelmed, and soldiers swung the heavy metal grill shut, locking it.
"We're sealed in!"
Chief Burke jumped on top of an overturned feed wagon. His face and upper torso were painted in the old war patterns, and he had the wing feather of a fire eagle thrust into his knotted iron-colored hair.
"Hit the son of a bitches! Get the gate back open, this way!"
He saw Uwe fall beneath a sword-wielding gray torque, and leaped down, brandishing the wide tomahawk Khalid Khan had forged for him. The blade sank into the soldier's crested bronze kettle helmet, as though it were made of pasteboard. Burke hauled the body off to find Guldenzopf lying flat on his back, one hand clutching his breast and an expression of agony on his bearded face. Burke knelt.
"Did he nail you, Bubby?"
Struggling up on one elbow, Uwe groped inside his buckskin shirt. Bone-colored bits gleamed in the lurid light.
"Only my second-best meerschaum, damn it!"
The lowlives remained hemmed in, unable to break out of the area in the immediate vicinity of the garrison complex. Those crowded in the breach were pressed both by the defenders and by their own comrades coming up from the beachhead. A wail of panic arose. Some invaders fell and were trampled. A garrison officer wearing a silver torque and full blue glass body armor directed a unit of halberdiers that advanced upon the stalled irregulars. Sweeping crystal blades mowed down the packed, shrieking throng. And then the monsters came to the rescue. High on the steep slope of rubble shone the wavering nightmare shape of a 3-meter albino scorpion, the illusionary aspect of Sharn the Younger, general of the Firvalog. From the minds of the exotics came a mighty wave of terror and dread that overloaded the telepathic circuits of the Greytorks and sent their wearers writhing into madness. Sharn himself could smite the enemy at a range of nearly 25 meters. Others of his advancing company might not have auras so formidable, but woe to the foe who fell into their clutches. Hideous trolls, specters, manticores, shambling dark presences seized the soldiers in spine-crunching embraces, sank fangs into unarmored throats, even rent men limb from limb.
Some of the exotics were capable of flinging bolts of psycho-energy that broiled troops in their bronze cuirasses like lobsters in the shell. Other Fearvalog harassed with sheets of astral fire, streams of nauseating ichor, or brain-crippling illusions. The great hero, Nukalavi the Skinless, wearing his aspect of a flayed centaur with blazing eyes, howled until enemy soldiers fell writhing to the ground, eardrums split, and minds reduced to near idiocy. Another champion, Bless Forfang, invaded the headquarters of the garrison, caught up the silver commander named Seaborg, and appeared to devour him, armor and all, while the dying officer calmly broadcast final telepathic orders to his subordinates directing the troops now making a last stand at the gate opening into the inner city. Seaborg's aides blunted their Vitradur weapons against Bless's scaly illusory hide, only to be eaten alive in turn for their temerity. By the time the monster had downed the last adjutant, the headquarters building was afire, and the invasion force swarmed in Fenaya's streets. So Bless withdrew in good order, picking his teeth with a silver spur. His appetite had only been whetted, and the morning was young. Vonda Jo was still overseeing the last wave of volunteers embarking from the staging area when Lord Beltane and the Flying Hunt took to the air. Shouts of fear came from the crowd as they saw the glowing knights mount up from the city across the water. One man yelled, "The bleeders are coming for us!" and jumped into the Rhine. A fiasco was averted when Vonda Jo tongue-lashed the outlanders for their cowardice, pointing out that the hunt was circling high above Fenaya, bent on some more urgent objective. "So into the boats and quit farting around," she bellowed. "You don't have to be afraid of Beltane and his flying circus anymore. Did you forget our secret weapon? We've got iron. You can kill Tano now, even easier than you can kill those traitor human torkers that do their dirty work." Eyeballs rolled anxiously in the half-light. The Fearvalog skipper in the two-masted shallop near Vonda Jo glowered in dwarfish impatience.
"Hurry it up, spiritless earthworms, or we'll sail to the war without you."
Suddenly, a column of emerald light stabbed down from apparently empty sky in the axis of the Wheeling Hunt, striking a low knoll within the city across the Rhine. Orange and white fire fountained up at the point of impact, and seconds later, the sound of a rolling detonation sped over the river.
"The mine!" somebody shouted. "The barium mine's blowing up! God, it looks like a volcano erupting in there!"
As if the bombardment had been a signal, another gout of flame belched up from the farthest reaches of Fenaya, back where the peninsula narrowed to a small neck connecting the city to the mainland.
"See that?" Vonda Jo was exultant. "That second wave of spooks has landed opposite our main beachhead. That female Fervalog named Aifa is attacking from the Black Forest side. Now will you shitheads get a move on?"
The men and women on the dock hoisted their iron-tipped spears into the air and yelled. They pounded down the spindly gangplanks into the waiting boat so eagerly that the small craft rocked and nearly swamped. On the other side of the Rhine, flames made a scarlet track on the dark water. The fairy lamps of blue and green and silver and gold that had outlined the splendid Tanu City of Lights began to wink out. Beltane, Lord of Fenaya, pulled up the reins of his chalico and hung in mid-air, shining like a magnesium flare. The nobles of his flying hunt, 18 male and 3 female knights, all glowing red, drew in their mounts to surround him. His thought thrust was nearly incoherent with frustration and rage.
"Gone! The flying machine is gone! And yet my lightning surely penetrated its belly! Camilda, send your Farsent seeking it!"
"It recedes from us, exalted lord. Artana, at a speed unprecedented, it drops behind the brow of the Vosges and beyond my perception. My lord, if I ascend to a great height..."
"Stay, Camilda! More urgent threats confront us now. Look, all of you! Look what the foe has done! Oh, the shame, the pain, the havoc! Down to the ground, all of you! Each to command a mounted party of chivalry in defense of our City of Lights. Nabardito! Nabardito tenel opogacon!"
The fighting moved steadily inland from the Rhineside break. 2 hours after dawn, the western front was strung through the gardens of the Pleasure Dome, on the very outskirts of the Tanu Quarter. Mo Marshak had reloaded his quiver several times from those of fallen comrades. He had wrenched the gaudy crest of his bronze helmet early on, and then rolled in filth to camouflage the shine of his cuirass. Unlike certain of his luckless fellows, he had deduced quickly that the Fervalog would be able to detect the telepathic communication, and so he made no attempts to contact his officers for orders. Maintaining a quiet mind, he went his lone way, keeping out of monster range as he skulked Fania's byways, potting lowlives with cool economy while dodging hysterical Ramas and non-combatants. Marshak had already taken out at least 15 of the enemy, plus 2 bareneck civilians he had caught looting a Greytorq corpse of its weaponry. Now Marshak slipped into the long porch that formed the perimeter of the Pleasure Dome. Hearing one of the distinctive lowlife yodels, he concealed himself behind thick ornamental shrubs and knocked one of the serrated war arrows in his compound bow. In the next instant, an unexpected diversion came from within the building. The stained glass from a pair of French doors, perhaps 5 meters away from the soldier, shivered to atoms from the impact of some heavy object. There were screams and a rumbling sound. Long hands, all adorned with rings, fumbled with the jammed catch. Other hands shook the bent framework. The angle was such that Marshak could not clearly see the people trapped inside, but their cries of terror and dismay reached both his mind and ears, as did the uncanny warbling of the thing pursuing them.
Help! The door's stuck, and it's coming!
Help us! Help, help, help us!
Help us!
The blanket coercive summons of a Tanu overlord clutched at Marshak's consciousness, his gray torque compelled obedience. Forsaking his hiding place, he ran to the door. On the other side, pressed against the mangled copper fretwork, were 3 female denizens of the Pleasure Dome and their tall Tanu client, whose handsome violet and gold robes proclaimed him an official of the Far Sensor Guild. He presumably lacked the coercive or psychokinetic potential to fend off the apparition that was now poised in an inner doorway, ready to strike. The Fervalog wore the appearance of a gigantic Helgramite, a larval water insect with clashing razor-sharp mandibles. The brute's head was nearly a meter wide, while the long segmented body, slick with some stinking secretion, seemed to fill the corridor behind it.
"Tana be thanked!" cried the Tanu. "Quickly, my man, aim for its neck!"
Marshak raised his bow, shifted position to avoid the struggling women, and let fly. The glass-tipped shaft sank for most of its length between chitinous plates behind the creature's scissoring jaws. Marshak heard the Fervalog utter a telepathic bellow. Without hurrying, he drew 2 more arrows and sent them into the Helgramite's glittering orange eyes. The insectile form wavered, became insubstantial, and then the awful thing was gone, and a dwarf in black obsidian armor lay dead on the floor, throat and eye sockets transfixed. The soldier used his Vitrador short sword to pry open the ruined latch. Pleasure surges, engendered by the grateful exotic, throbbed along his pelvic nerves in the sweet, familiar reward. When the nobleman and his disheveled companions were freed, Marshak saluted, right fist pressed against his heart. "I am at your service, exalted lord." But the Far Sensor dithered.
"Where are we to go? The route to House Feltane is cut off."
His abstracted expression showed that he was scanning about with his mind's eye.
"Well, we can't go back inside,"
said the most petite of the Pleasure Dome inmates, a black woman of exquisite contours and sharp voice.
"The damn muffers are crawling out of the woodwork."
"Oh, Lord Galastair,"
squealed a teary blonde.
"Save us."
"Silence," commanded the Tanu.
"I'm attempting to, but no one will respond to my summons."
The third woman, thin and empty-eyed, her provocative attire half torn from her bony shoulders, sank down on the pavement and began to laugh. Galatair gasped.
"The dome is surrounded! I call, but Lord Veltane's knights are in the thick of battle! Ha, the invaders cringe and retreat before the coercive might of Tanu chivalry! The goddess be thanked! There are many more powerful than I.
A great jarring thump came from inside the pleasure dome. Distant cries became louder. More glass broke and a rhythmic pounding began.
They're coming! The monsters are coming!
Once again, the blonde burst into hysterical tears.
Soldier, you must lead us,
the Tanu scowled, shook his head as if to clear it.
Lead us to the northern water gate. There may be a boat.
But it was too late. Across the garden, trampling flower beds and hurtling through the bushes, came a force of 20-odd low-life humans, led by a half-naked red man of heroic stature. Marshak's hand poised over his quiver, frozen. Most of the invaders had compound bows, as good as his own, held at the ready.
Surrender!
Shouted Peopale Mox Mox Burke.
Amnesty for all humans who yield freely to us!
Stand back! Cried the Tanu Far Censor. I will burn out your minds, strike you mad!
Chief Burke smiled, and his painted face, framed in straggling gray hair, was more menacing than the Fervalog phantasm had ever been. The exotic man knew that his bluff was useless, just as he knew there would be no amnesty for those of his race. Commanding Marshak to defend to the death, Gulpir tried to flee. The iron tomahawk spun and split the exotic skull before he had taken two steps. Marshak relaxed. He let the bow and arrow fall to the flagstones and watched the approaching lowlives in numb silence. The strategic importance of the barium mine had been made clear to Sharnmez at the lowlife briefing session prior to the invasion. Humiliation of the hated foe, the Fervalog general was made to understand, must take second place to the complete destruction of the mine and its trained personnel. It was vital to Madame Gudrian's grand design that the supply of the precious element, indispensable in the manufacture of Torx, be cut off. Shortly before noon, when Sharn was taking a breather with Bless and Nukalavi, in a makeshift command post well supplied with liberated beer, a Fervalog scout arrived with important news. The mighty Aepha and her warrior ogresses had made a successful thrust from the eastern breach and now invested the sector around the mine workings. They had ascertained that molten rock, triggered by Claude's blast from the spear, had plugged the mine entrance, buried the main refinery and the complex that housed the human and Rama workers, and flowed some distance into the streets of the upper city before congealing. However, the mine administration building, with its store of purified barium, stood firm. The place was completely surrounded by black and steaming lava, now sheathed in a clinkery skin of cooled rock except where cracks revealed the red glowing interior. There were still Tanu engineers in the building, and among them, a creator of the first rank. Aepha and her force had gleaned this intelligence when an unexpected bolt of psycho-energy zapped one of the investigating ogresses to a cinder, narrowly missing the dreadful scathe. She of the snaggle teeth and dripping talons had spun a psychic shield over the survivors that sufficed for a disorderly retreat out of mind-bolt range.
And so, the mighty Aepha, the scout concluded, now awaits your suggestions, great captain.
Bless uttered a hoarse bleat of ironic laughter. He tipped half a barrelful of beer into his maw.
Ah, let's go help the poor little ladies save their honor.
Honor my left testicle, hissed Nukalavi. If the foeman's creative force strained the defense of Scathe, then he is a worthy antagonist to any of us at a distance. We would expend our mind power simply in the erection of screens and have little left for offense.
Even the approach is fraught with danger, Sharn noted. The crust of cooling lava, as this scout says, is fragile and may crack under the weight of a stalwart. You know our minds cannot penetrate dense rock deeply enough to strengthen the crust, and to fall through into the magma below is certain doom. He addressed himself to the dwarf messenger. Plickthorn, how broad is the expanse of lava that would have to be crossed?
At least 50 giant steps, great captain.
Plickthorn's face became eager.
The crust would bear my weight easily.
You could send me and Nukalavi to mind guard him, along with Aepha and Scathe, Bless suggested. The four of us, working together, have the range.
And what happens when our brave gnomish brother reaches the mine building?
Nukalavi sneered. How will he attack the foe through our own mental screens? Forfang, you've worn that reptile suit so long that your wits are shrinking to fit your illusory brain pan. The great Captain Aether, cautioned the scout, has perceived that the Tanu engineers are calling upon Lord Veltaine for help. Shorn smacked a great hand onto the table.
His tonsils, and when he responds, he'll airlift them out, bury them and all. We can't take that chance. I hate like hell to resort to low-life tactics, but there's only one way to handle this.
Easy does it, lads, Aether called out. Don't lose your nerve now that you're almost there.
Ami, the little Singhalese iron smelter, clutched Plickthorn's neck tighter. The lava crust bent as the Fervalog approached the lee of the mine building. There the flow was thicker, and it held the heat longer, which meant that the skin of cooled rock might crack and let them fall through to the magma at any moment. About the incongruous bric-a-brac figure shone a radiant hemisphere, the mental screen conjured by the joint power of Aether, Skaith, Bless, and Nukalavi. The four heroes and most of the force of warrior ogresses were concealed behind the sturdy walls of burnt-out townhouses, well back from the edge of the lava flow and a full 200 meters from the mine headquarters. Energy bolts flung by the trapped Tanu creator blazed from an upper-story window, disintegrating into a web of lightnings as they were neutralized by the screen's potential. At length, Plickthorn and Harmy reached a lower window and climbed inside. Aether, who was strong in the far-sensing talent, observed what happened next. The three foemen descend to the lower chamber armed with Vitrador geology picks. One of them has considerable coercive power. He's trying to force Plickthorn to lower the screen, but that won't work, of course. The mind bolt flinger now gathers his strength for one mighty thrust at point-blank range. He uses steady pressure rather than abrupt projection. Our screen wavers. It goes spectral into the blue, the yellow. It will surely fail. But now the lowlife has his arbalest ready and aims at the creator. Ah! The missile of blood metal passes through our weakening shield as through a curtain of rain. The foeman falls. A second shot, and a third, and all of the foe are downed. The four heroes leapt, and the warrior ogresses whooped with joy in the triumph. All of their minds, even at the great distance, felt the death flare of first one Tanu mind, then a second. But the mind bolt flinger was strong even in the dying. Amplified, agonized, his thought thundered in the ether.
The goddess will avenge us. Accursed through the world's age by those who resort to the blood metal. A bloody tide will overwhelm them.
An instant later, his soul flickered out. The lowlife named Hani, having retrieved the three iron quarrels for reuse in his crossbow, appeared at the window and waved. Then he and Plickthorn set to work chipping and prying at the heavy limestone windowsill until its mortar gave way. The stone smashed the thin lava crust beneath the window, sending up a gush of smoke and flame. Before the first rift could heal, the human and the Fervalog were seen to toss certain small containers into the pit of molten rock, after which they climbed out a different window and made their way carefully back the way they had come. A young girl, clad in shiny black, jogged in apparent tirelessness along the narrow Vosges jungle trail. Shadows grew deeper, and a cool wind swept from the heights into the ravine that the footpath followed. Tree frogs were beginning their evening songs. Before long, the predators would awaken. After nightfall, there would be so many hostile creatures on the prowl that Felice would be unable to fend them off with her coercive power. She would be forced to bivouac and wait until dawn.
And I'll be too late. The truce starts at sunup, and the war in Fenaya will be over.
How far had she come? Perhaps 2/3 of the 106 kilometers that lay between Hidden Springs and the western bank of the Rhine? She had lost so much time this morning before getting started, and the sun went down at 1800 hours.
Damn Richard! Damn him for getting hurt!
She should have insisted on going with them in the flyer. She could have done something. Helped old Claude steady the spear. assisted Madame's mental defense, even deflected the globe of ball lightning that had blinded Richard in one eye, and caused him to crash the flyer.
Damn him! Damn him!
The Fervalog will quit fighting when the truce begins and our people will have to withdraw. I'll be too late to get my golden torque. Too late!
She splashed heedlessly across a small stream. Ravens, disturbed in their feeding upon some otter's leftovers, rose squawking into the vine-hung forest canopy. A hyena mocked her, its mad laugh echoing from the ravine wall. Too late. The glass carnix of a fighting Tanner woman sounded the charge. Armored chalicos, bearing knights who coruscated each in a different jewel color, galloped down the corpse-strewn boulevard toward the barricade where the contingent of lowlives was making its stand.
Nabardito! Nabardito!
There were no Fervalog allies at hand to dampen the mental assault. Images of brain-searing intensity whipped and stabbed at the humans. The night was fraught with unspeakable menace and pain. Plunging exotics in their sparkling harness seemed to be coming from all directions, gorgeous and invulnerable. The humans loosed iron-tipped arrows, but skillful psychokinetics among the Tanu turned most of the fusillade aside, while the rest clattered harmlessly against the plates of the glass armor.
"The spooks! Where are the spooks?"
howled a despairing lowlife. A moment later, one of the knights crashed upon him, impaling his claw-torn body with a sapphire lance. Of the 63 human beings who had made their stand in that street, only 5 escaped into the narrow alleys where hanging awnings, lines of washing, and crowded ranks of rubbish carts abandoned by panicked Rama sanitary workers made it impossible for the mounted Tanu to follow. A mammoth bonfire was ablaze in the central plaza of Phanaya. Jubilant phantoms in 100 hideous guises capered around it, waving battle standards festooned with strings of freshly psycho-gilded skulls. Khalid Khan protested.
"They're wasting time, Mighty Sharn. Our people are taking a terrible beating when they meet the Tanu unsupported by Fervalog mind cover. Even the mounted Grey Torques can cut right through our infantry. We've got to work together, and we must find some way to counter those Chalico riders."